Can I interrupt real quick? There's a small chance we just had an earthquake. The whole building shook for quite a while. Mike, I really think we just had an earthquake.
Do you have earthquakes in
Never.
New York?
I mean, maybe there are some, but...
Have you experienced an earthquake before?
No, I slept through one in Northern California once. Oh my, that's the first conscious earthquake I've ever experienced in 47 years.
Well, friends, I wanted you to just get to experience that before we got into this. In a moment, I'm going to introduce you to my friend, Aaron Nyquist, who, while we were recording, he was at his home in New York, and in the midst of us looking at each other on the video screen, he becomes incredibly concerned as his camera is shaking, and we caught his very first earthquake experience as New York was having that 4.8 earthquake that those of us in California were like, what are you so concerned about? But like, that's a big deal if you haven't actually experienced that. Although my daughter, when she was talking about the earthquake later that day, she's like, I won't even get out of bed unless it's at least a 5.0. So we definitely have different experiences here. But anyways, I was editing that out. Wanted you to get to hear it before we jumped into everything. So proper introduction and everything is coming, but just wanted us to share in that experience together. Welcome back to the Space for Faith podcast. I am Mike Goldsworthy, and it is a gift to have you with us today. We're continuing on in the series that we've been going through. We've called The Divine Conspiracy Project, where we are just walking through this book that for me and so many others has been so influential. And we're walking through a chapter at a time. This week, we are on chapter 3, and I've got my friend Aaron Nyquist joining us all the way from New York City. And Aaron's going to get into it with us here in a bit. But Aaron is a liturgist, a writer, a pastor out in New York. And Aaron, I was realizing it was about almost exactly 2 years ago that you were last with us on the podcast. And we were talking about new liturgies and formation. And we were talking about something that was like newer for you at the time, your pastors, priests, and guides. It was a retreat at the time. And now you've got several of those under your belt, and it's grown into something so much more. And so, like, first, like, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being back. And then I want to hear a little bit more about what's going on with all of that work.
Hey, well, so good to be with you. Glad to have this conversation officially. Kind of, we have these conversations on the side, and so this is fun to be back on the podcast. Yeah, I mean, like, you're exactly right. A couple years ago, we were just looking around, and it came out of a series of conversations that I was having with my pastor and priest friends. And every one of us was despairing and despondent and exhausted. And I had two coffees in a back-to-back where both a pastor and a priest said, if I didn't get paid by my church, I wouldn't even go to it. And it was just this moment of, we collectively, those of us who are part of the American church, are not doing okay. We got to get the band together. We have to have a space, A, to be able to name that honestly and safely, and then B, to explore the kinds of practices that might invite us into health, into wholeness, into solidarity, into reimagination. And so, yeah, we started, it's called Pastors, Priests, and Guides. And we have three retreats this year, one coming up in Chicago in May. We have one in Philadelphia in July. And then we have one at the end of the year in November in Malibu. And so pretty excited about that. But yeah, the work has been deeply meaningful. It's very ecumenical. The group of guides, of women and men who lead us, are from all kinds of different Christian faith traditions, and that's been some of the gift of getting all together, I think.
I love that. And then I saw you were launching something. Did you call it like Between the Retreats?
Yeah,
like
very creatively named Between Retreats. It's basically a space between retreats for the community to stay connected. And so the first month, we have a different guide every month. The first month, poet and good friend Drew Jackson was on. And then we just started in April for this month, and Sarah Bessie is our guide. And I mean, it's just what she, I don't know if you've read her new book yet, Field Notes for the Wilderness, but it's wonderful. And just helping giving, not just helping name what has happened to so many of us, but also offering practices and constructive ways through, which I really love.
Yeah, it's so good. I haven't gotten to make it out yet. I've like tried to figure out how to make it work. Maybe I can make Malibu work since that's up the road.
Sorry
for me
you have
this
to
year.
Slum it in Malibu, but you know.
Yeah, it's a rough place to have to visit, but if you gotta go, you gotta go. But I've connected with several folks that have been a part of some of these and just come back talking about like how meaningful and helpful it's been for them. I'm really grateful you're doing this.
Thank you.
I'll put a link in the show notes for folks, but where do they find all the info?
Yeah, the central place is our website, Pastors, Priests, and Guides. Our main social media place is Instagram. So the Pastors, Priests, and Guides Instagram account is probably the way to stay in touch. But again, it's been so meaningful for me. I've been trying to not lose my faith for years and to be with others who are heartbroken by many of the same things, but are not giving up on the way of Jesus. That has been so heartening for me. So
good. So good. Well, I think that's a fantastic segue into what we came to talk about.
You're a pro.
Mr. Willard and his book that for so many of us became a thing that was helpful in some ways saving our faith or reimagining our faith for some of us. I'm kind of curious, like, what your origin story is of like how you became familiar with Dallas.
Yeah.
How did you stumble across this book? What did that look like for you?
So I went to Christian College and in the Chicago area, Judson University. And those 4 years they were actually great years. But by the end, I was getting a little bit cynical. Just a little bit, you know, I don't know. And then I got a job at a church, Willow Creek, right down the road, and my faith promptly disintegrated. And I was, you know, 6 months into my first ministry job, and I didn't know if I believed any of the songs that I was inviting people to sing. And it's easy to look back at it now, that was part of the story, whatever. If I put myself back in that place, it was so scary and terrifying. I felt like I was not just losing my faith. I was losing my mind. I was losing would I lose my family? Would I lose my relationships? Would I lose my job? I mean, it was very, very, it was a real big deal. And I had one friend, Chris, who was walking with me, and he said, "Have you ever read this book?" And I was desperate enough, and he gave me Divine Conspiracy, and I started it, and it's not a laugh a minute. It's dry. And I remember getting started thinking, well, you know, but I was desperate. And I was in Michigan for some reason. And I remember like literally I was sitting on the floor, leaning up against the couch in this space. And I was reading the Gospels of Sin Management. And it was halfway through that book, that chapter, that I started crying. And I didn't know why. And especially at that point, I was not a crier. I was pretty locked up. And it was the beauty of the invitation. You know, growing up in kind of fundamentalist Christian circles, I'd really internalized that the Christian story is believe these three things so you don't go to hell, and then try not to swear or have sex with your girlfriend. Like it was pretty small, this invitation. And as I was reading Dallas's invitation, no, it's to get swept up in what God is doing to redeem and restore all things. I mean, that's the invitation. And I just remember thinking, if that's what we're being called into, I'm in. Like I'm in for good. And that is really, you know, I've had a number of, that was, 20 years ago? I've had a number of ebbs and flows, and some things have had to let go of some things. But that initial calling to the kingdom has been the foundation. So yeah, I can't say enough about this book. I don't know if it's a great book or if it just happened to be the right book at the right moment. But it is so special. I met Dallas a couple times, and the first time I met him, I said, "Can I tell you a quick story?" And I told him that story, and he like was kind of awkward. He looked down and kind of shy, and he just said, "Thank you." And I walked out of the room, and I walked down the hall, and I went into the bathroom and went into one of the stalls and just bawled my eyes out. Like it was so meaningful to get to thank him. I mean, he didn't know, and so meaningful.
Yeah. It's so wild to me, and we were just talking about this before we started recording, that like how many of us in our generation have these stories with this particular book. And it is curious, like, is it that it's this like magnificent book? Is it that it was right thing at the right time? Yeah. But like, there's so many of us who would say like, this book like changed me, that this book opened me up in new ways, that this is sort of ground zero for whatever like sort of shift came, or even like saving our faith in some ways. Yep. It's so fascinating. I'm kind of curious. You mentioned you've been, you didn't just read the chapter that we're covering. Like you decided to start over.
Yeah. I'm diving back into the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've all been like tracking along. Like folks have been reading with us. I've been reading through. Like, I'm kind of curious for you, before we get into this particular chapter, like what have you noticed, or what has that done in you, or like what's that been like kind of re-engaging this book that was so meaningful?
Yeah. You know, on one hand, there have been a couple moments where, and I actually bought a new book because I love to read with a pen. So I'm kind of re-underlining, rewriting in the margins and all that. And I found myself like almost rediscovering some things that have been so important. There's one sentence, I don't remember what chapter, but it's, "We are never ceasing, eternal beings, called uniquely to count completely for good in God's universe."
Huh.
And I stumbled upon that, and I was like, oh, so I underlined it a bunch of times. That's a chorus from a song I wrote from the book, like
really
20 years ago. I've actually never played it live, but it's in a notebook and I love it. Sometimes I just sing it at the piano. Well, how cool was that to discover, oh yeah, it's from this book. I just pulled the exact quote and turned it into a chorus. So there's been a number of those moments. There have been some moments that, you know, the Gospels of Sin Management, when I read it, I was coming out of the fundamentalism of, you know, substitutionary atonement is the whole story. And so this was such a fresh invitation. Well, now I'm a liturgist at an Episcopal church in Manhattan. I'm on the other side of that, you know, those two extremes. And I'm often watching the gospel be shrunk down to social engagement. And so, now experiencing the new way has just been fascinating.
Huh. I love that. Well, the chapter we're getting into, chapter 3, Dallas titles, "What Jesus Knew, Our God-Bathed World." And the way he opens up the chapter, I love, like, he says that the good news of the kingdom can only make sense if we share Jesus's view of the world. And then this feels like the way that he then framed so much of it, that it's a God-bathed, God-permeated world. And he has like particular kind of views of what that means and what that looks like getting fleshed out. But I'm kind of curious for you, like even just at the get-go, how that line, that idea kind of strikes you.
Yeah. Well, some of the reason why I was really excited to talk about this chapter with you, I jumped at the chance to talk about this one, is because the first time I read it about 20 years ago, this was one of the most boring chapters in the whole book. And I remember just kind of skipping through thinking, what is he talking about? And yet, when I look back over the last 20 years, other than the Gospels of Sin Management, that understanding shifting from substitutionary atonement to joining God and what God is doing, other than that, the number one concept, invitation, however you'd talk about it, that has altered my faith and my ministry is this idea that God is not up on a cloud somewhere, but it is in God we live, move, and have our being. I mean, when I started, you know, when I started leading worship, like all worship leaders, I would say things like, God, we welcome you to this place today. You know, please join us in this sanctuary. As if God's out in the parking lot, you know, waiting to hear God's favorite song, you know. I mean, it just, it betrays, where do we think God is? When we tell a story, you know, where we say, and then God showed up.
Uh-huh.
From where? God was somewhere and wasn't somewhere. And then God, you know, so God, please be with us on this drive today. Well, I know what that is. And I pray versions of that. But after Dallas, it shifted from God, please join us in the car to keep us safe, to God, we will be with you this whole drive. Would you help me pay attention on the road to stay safe? You know, it sounds like a slight nuance, but it has been a fundamental shift. As a worship leader, I no longer think it's my job to play the right songs in the right way that convinces God to show up. Now, I wonder if it's my job to play the songs in the right way that help us show up. God's been here all along. How do we open up to what's been true from the beginning?
Yeah, just, that's so good.
Yeah, it's been a seismic shift for me. And it started because of Dallas. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that makes me think of from, it's a bit later in the chapter, so I'll skip over a bit to go to it. But he says something. Oh, here's what he writes. He says, the heavens progressively open to us as our character and understanding are increasingly attuned to the realities of God's rule from the heavens. And then he quotes this vision that Julian of Norwich shares, which reminded me of like the experience that Thomas Merton has that's been really shaping for me the past few years, when he describes like that he's standing on a street corner in Louisville. And then all of a sudden that like he has this experience where he's overwhelmed with the realization that like at the way that he loves these people that he doesn't know, he says they're shining like the sun. And so Willard begins to talk about this, like this when you live with this sort of opening awareness to the heavens being opened all around you, in which he says the heavens is God's presence. That's the way the New Testament, when New Testament talks about heaven, it's not this other realm or place, but it's like God's presence. And then he says that as you grow in this awareness of it, that all it begins to change the way that you see people, that way that you're encountering folks on the streets. What I'm kind of curious for you, what your experience then has been of that, have you had those moments of shifting where you begin to see people, see experiences, see places differently as you grow in this awareness of being permeated with the heavens?
Yeah, absolutely. And that shifting often begins, and I don't know if this is universal or if this is me because I'm more of an introvert. The shift usually begins when I'm alone, whether it's in my prayers or in my personal practice or sitting in silence. It's a shift from God, where are you? Come close, to you're already here, so am I. So that shift usually begins there, but absolutely it expands into every conversation. I had a, oh man, there's so many things I want to say. This is so close to how I'm still a Christian. Let me say this first. A pastor friend was reflecting on Dallas's teaching and brought it down to the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven." And he said, another translation could be "Our Father who is in the heavens, who fills the heavens, who fills every molecule from the farthest solar system to the inside of my actual being." And then he said, "Our Father who is closer than the air we breathe."
Huh.
And I have thought about that so many times. Where is God? As close as the air we breathe. And so, again, that changes my prayers. That changes how I'm trying to lead a worship or a communal practice experience. Community, God's already here. Let's do A, B, and C to try to open ourselves up to that reality. Well, that's pretty compelling. And yeah. Then I wrote this little prayer, and this is probably 10 years ago. I started praying it before every person I'd meet at coffee, or especially at that time, I was part of a church staff that was pretty contentious. Before every staff meeting I would walk into. And I don't know if I can quote it exactly, but the heart was, "God who fills the universe, every molecule, God who fills me and the person I'm about to talk to, help us notice your nearness in that person and in myself and tend to the presence together." I butchered it a little bit, but the heart was walking into every coffee shop knowing God's already there and not saying I'm bringing God there because I'm so spiritual, but naming God's already with that person, whether they're religious or not. I mean, they may be totally untuned into that reality. That doesn't make them any less an image of our Creator. And so it just expands who I believe is in God.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, and I know that you have been with Telos. I remember a trip that I did with Telos to Israel-Palestine. And that experience of moving from seeing people from enemy or seeing them from other, where like you meet with people with so many different competing narratives, and you're meeting with a rabbi in a kibbutz, and you're meeting with a Palestinian farmer, and you're meeting with an imam, and you're meeting with people on like so many different areas of the conflict. And each time I would walk away with like, oh, they have the right viewpoint. And I had this like right and wrong sort of like, I need to figure out which is the right side to be on of all of this.
Right.
And I felt like one of the shifts that happened in me through that trip was to begin to see like, to sit in the paradox where it's this complexity where I have space for the humanity of people who I would have considered others. Yeah. And begin to see them differently. And for me, that became one of those sort of like experiences that I think Dallas is describing there, of that sort of like God permeated world where like you're seeing God in the other, in all of humanity. And it, and then you walk away with, the inability to put people into binary categories that we're so often prone to do.
Yeah, I love that. There's such a graciousness in that. And there's such a consenting to reality in that, which is some of how I would sum up Dallas's entire chapter here. He's not appealing for, here's why I think you should import this belief onto your brain or heart or religious life. He's suggesting, this is how everything is. Will you consent to that reality?
Yes.
It's one of my favorite. I think this is from a different book, maybe his book on disciplines. But he says, Jesus' teachings are not arbitrary rules that we should follow or God will punish us. They're simple observations about how the universe actually works.
Yes.
So we don't not gossip because gossip is a sin and God will punish us. We don't gossip because it breaks relationship. It's almost like Jesus is pleading with us to live in the life-bringing way. And that's what I felt in this chapter over and over. He gets into such non-concrete you know, imagery for so much of it. But the invitation is so concrete. Join reality.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so good. And it is, in a lot of ways, he's pretty esoteric in some of this. And like one of the things he said that I don't remember it striking me on previous readings, but one of the things that struck me in this reading was he says that no place, I think, does our contemporary mindset more strongly conflict with the life and good news of Jesus than over the understanding of space.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole thing that we've been talking about, that he's like,
yes,
we can take God and make God in some other place, or we can say, he says, like, that God, that you end up in this place where it's like God lives in your heart.
Yeah, that's right.
And you sort of like remove God and make God distant, or you make God so hyper localized that you miss that like larger permeation that, and I thought it was so fascinating that he would say like, you actually, that's actually in conflict with experiencing the life and good news of Jesus when you view God in one of those ways.
I had an activist friend who used to say, we had talked a lot about going into God-forsaken places in the world.
Oh, yeah.
He said, no such thing. There are church-forsaken places. There are no God-forsaken places. And that really resonated deeply.
Yeah. And like it, for it to, the view of God that we have of who God is, what is God like? What are God's characteristics and attributes matters with this, right? Because if it's God permeated and God is a angry judge, or God is looking to catch you in your wrongdoing or whatever, like that changes things.
Yeah.
But Dallas suggests, and this is, I think, one of the things that has messed with me a good bit that I keep coming back to trying to like, I don't know if it's trying to understand it or trying to embody it, but that God as the most joyous being in the universe.
Yeah.
Like we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
But that would, that fundamentally changes the way that we view God, the way we like even think of like what's happening in our universe.
Yeah. I that really struck me in this reading too. And, I felt 75% resonance, 25% dissonance in that.
Yeah. Tell me
if
about
I'm
that.
Really honest. Are we allowed to have dissonance with Dallas Willard? And I felt it. It was such a refreshing, and it felt that it could be profoundly true, especially as he built the case for what God sees and what God, you know. I think though, unless there's a side-by-side weeping, then I don't know if I can, I don't know how far I can go into the only joy.
Yeah.
If God is only joyful in Gaza right now, God is monstrous. So now, again, I'm reading my melancholy Enneagram 4-ness onto the eternal. So that could be the fallacy that I'm bringing here. But, you know, what we just read, it must have been in the lectionary recently, where Jesus wept at the tomb of Lazarus, knowing full well that he was about to bring Lazarus back. He wept with his friends who were weeping. And that is a God that I can stay close to, that I can trust with all parts of my life. So the joy of God is really important because I also don't need like a weepy mopey creator.
Sure.
But if this joyful God's heart can also break, then there's something there that that I feel safe moving close to.
Yeah. I think that word safety feels really important. And I think it's kind of interesting to think about how is it, I don't know if how is the right question. So I'll say my thing and then like do with it what you want. Okay. I think the idea to be able to say God has to be like this in order for me to come close to him, to be able to say something like that requires a sense that God is safe enough for me to push back on some things, to like need to see God in this way. And I think that Dallas tries to present a kind like, I think he says something to the effect of like, this world is a perfectly safe place to be. You have to like, so there has to be some level of safety and security in your view of God to say God permeates the whole world. And yet I also feel safe enough to be able to say, I need God to show up like this for that God to be a God I can come close to you. I'd be kind of curious to hear about the idea of like safety within all of that. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's such a good question. And I mean, it's hard for you and me to talk too much about safety because we're both sitting in very safe locations right now. Yet I don't know what to do with that because that is my experience. And so, you know, I'm immediately thinking about the great C.S. Lewis. He's not safe, but he's good.
Yeah.
But the goodness is a bring safety, a certain kind, right? Like, I don't have a great response. I could make something up. I think that is a tension that I really feel.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, well, even Journey that you talked about a little bit ago of, having all these questions and then even having your own experiences of ebbs and flows, right? Like I've got my own experiences of that as well. And in order to, like, there's a view of God that doesn't allow ourselves to go to those places, right? Yeah. That God is not safe, is not a safe place to go with those things. Yeah. And so you either constrict yourself to never letting your mind kind of go there, or you abandon the whole project. And there's some sort of sense of like moving to a place where God is safe enough to wrestle with all that, to bring all of that, to allow for the ebbs and the flows, and even to allow for, I was on somebody's podcast a while ago, a month or so ago. And one of the things we're talking about how is in the kind of church experience I had for a while, I was always told like pursue truth wherever it leads you. And what we really meant by that was pursue truth wherever it leads you, as long as you arrive at one of these three conclusions.
Yeah, that's right.
But to actually pursue truth wherever it leads you with this like sort of open-ended thing means like you have a sense of safety of wherever I arrive will be good.
Yeah.
I don't have to control it, and I don't have to constrict it.
Yeah. Yeah. The word safe can mean a lot of different things, and some are probably really, really accurate for our creator, and some are really just projections. You know, I was just thinking at a kind of in broad strokes, if I'm an addict and I come to God, God is safe enough to say, Aaron, come as you are. I'm not going to smite you. Bring your whole addicted self. Now let's get you clean. So if I think safety means I can just do whatever I want and God won't ever tell me what to do, well, I'm misreading that. But you better believe God is saying, I mean, you know, the prodigal son story is perpetually beautiful, watching the father run out down the driveway and fall down. So that is what God is like. And I think God is saying, let's help you not wreck your life anymore.
That's good. Okay, I want to take it to a totally different place.
Okay.
Where he talks a bit about like, well, here, I'll just read the quote and then I'll talk. This is one of the places where I feel a little conflicted from this chapter. He says, I'm a spiritual being who currently has a physical body. I occupy my body in its proximate space, but I am not localized in it or around it. And then a little bit later in the chapter, he talks about it's similar to the quote that you said earlier that I'm going to see if I can find it. Oh, we're never ceasing spiritual beings with an eternal destiny in the full world of God. So here was where like I found myself a little bit, pushing back a little bit on it or whatever, is it felt to me a little bit like a diminishment of the physical body and a diminishment of the very intentional incarnational quality of not only God revealed in Jesus, but of like the whole world. And so the idea, like, I'm a spiritual being who currently has a physical body. And like, one of the ways I've been pretty influenced is by also by N.T. Wright in thinking around this, who would talk about the idea of we have resurrected physical bodies. Jesus had a resurrected physical body, and that this earth, it like there's a recreated new heaven and new earth that's restored, redeemed, and that's like the eternal experience happens in this physical locality. And so like I try not to spend a lot of time anymore in like theological debates about particulars that used to like get me down rabbit holes. But this one like hit me a bit because I think our physicality matters and it's a part of the original good creation. And I want to push against ways that seem to deny that. And so I'm curious on like, did you hear that in Willard there? Did you like, am I missing something here?
No, I heard that really clearly. And I had the same feeling of, oh no, this is just that disembodied. But then I thought, no. It's Dallas Willard who taught me that the body and what we do matters. So yeah. I think this is just where he's building this part of the case. I think taken even in just this one book, let alone all his writings, I think he has such a robust invitation. I can remember him saying, our bodies are the only way in which we engage reality, you know? So I think he has a real high view of the body, but in this chapter, he's talking about the unceasing nature of our existence. So,
yeah, he's trying to build this other thing. 'Cause he does say at some point, like the best things about, I don't remember, says it about humanity are things that are unseen, that it's like love is intangible, but it's like the best part of our human experience.
Yeah. And so, again, I think taken on its own, this chapter on its own would not do it for me. But I think what he's trying to construct, this chapter is doing a particular thing. So that's my way to agree 100% with your discomfort. But I think Dallas is inviting us into something bigger. So
yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's helpful. It's helpful even like in... it's so easy to decontextualize something, to take a quote like that and to miss or forget the larger work that's going on around it and to, try to localize it within a larger work.
Yeah.
Well, he later on in the chapter talks about the idea of having faith in faith or belief in belief. And says like, and then in that same sort of section, he says, I think that there's a lot of people who believe in Jesus, but not God. What do you like think he means by all of this?
I don't know. I do, that that was a little, it wasn't, it felt even a little out of place with the argument he was building right at that moment. So I remember thinking, wow, what a beautiful quote. I don't know if I could explain that. If I were to step back and maybe not try to unpack that quote, but maybe get a little bit, what it seems like he's getting at is that idea that, and this is my language, not his, we love Jesus as a mascot, but not as a guide. We trust Jesus for the object of our worship and devotion, but not for the person who teaches us how to live in this world. And that is, I mean, we are seeing that play out in our country so profoundly that many people who are the loudest about Jesus also yelling about anti-Jesus kinds of things. And we all do it. We all fall short. But there is a difference between saying, hey, I've fallen short again of the way I'm trying to follow, and what seems to be happening in some quarters of, we don't even try to do that kind of stuff. That's not what we're about. But we're using Jesus' name for this other thing. And so, I wonder if Dallas is just constantly trying to appeal to trusting Jesus means doing what he said. Do we do that? And that is a challenge for me.
Well, it's definitely like the idea that, you were talking about this earlier, of that, like, Jesus is inviting us into experiencing reality and to trust that he actually knows, like, this is the best way to experience reality. And I think Dallas says it something like, we have to trust Jesus to actually be smart.
Yeah.
Which is such a, like, I feel like this is one of those ones that I continually come back to with Willard and, like, wrestle around and think about, like, what do you do with this? That you have to trust him to be the smartest person in the world, that he actually, like, knows how the world works, knows how to be in the world, knows how to, like, do the stuff. And so it's exactly what you're talking about, like, that it's like we can't create this dichotomy of sort of trusting him in an esoteric, disembodied kind of sense without, like, trusting that, like, he actually knows how to help us engage in the best, most real way in the world.
Yes. I mean, let's take one concrete example that feels really alive right now. What are we to do with our enemies? Whether we're talking about, you know, the current Israel-Palestine thing that's happening in Gaza, Iran, I mean, whether we're talking about that really, whether we're talking about what do we do with our political enemies, whatever that means right now. Again, Jesus was really clear on that. And for us to struggle to put it into practice, I think, is to be human. For us to say, nah, that doesn't apply. Jesus would want us to defeat and destroy our enemies. Well, that's a different, that's not Jesus anymore. So that might be a version of American Christianity. That's not the way of Christ. The way of Christ is different than that. And so we have to wrestle with that tension there. And again, I don't think Jesus is saying, here's my arbitrary rule, do it or I'll punish you. Jesus is wise enough to know what happens when we let hatred go deep into our hearts, when we let unforgiveness run amok. I mean, what's that great quote that's been quoted a million times? Unforgiveness is drinking poison, hoping it hurts somebody else.
Yeah.
That is a profound truth. That is something that in my life, I have two different situations where I regularly go back to the poison, thinking I'm keeping myself safe or thinking I'm fighting for justice in this situation. Jesus is not just saying, do this rule or I'll punish you. Jesus is observing, you will destroy your life and everyone around you if you do not forgive. And Ron Rollheiser has said, this is my paraphrase, in the second half of life, almost the only thing we have to do is forgive. Huh. Forgive ourselves, forgive each other, forgive God for not coming through. And then he says, and forgive the whole universe for just being so damn disappointing. And that, man, that there is something, that is the universe that God under, that Jesus understood and understands, that if we fight against it, we're not going to win. We have to let it go. Easy to say on a podcast, very difficult to do.
Yeah, that's where Dallas ends up ending the chapter, really in this place of like, can we actually, like he says, Jesus is Lord can mean little in practice if we can't say Jesus is smart. Mm-hmm. Like, can we actually like trust that the ways of Jesus are actually good and right and better, and that they actually make sense when even they don't fully make sense to us, and when even we end up in sort of tribal spaces that want us to, we become enculturated to want to act in certain other kinds of ways. Yeah. And he builds this whole thing to say like, no, we can actually trust him that his way actually leads to what is good and right and real.
Yeah. And again, this is straight learning from Dallas. I almost want to push back on that idea of trusting that Jesus is smart.
Okay.
Because so much of what we're raised to do is just that trust that Jesus was right.
Yeah,
that he knew what he was doing, that he was God's son, that, you know, and it stays in the realm of intellectual assent. The trust is the doing. So it's like, you know, it's so funny. I'm going to jump into the like practice-based thing that I've spent so much of my life working on, because this has been such, so revelatory for me. Sometimes I feel like church or like small groups are runners clubs where all we do is read books about running and debate correct running techniques.
Sure. That's good.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it can be helpful. It doesn't matter unless we run. And so there's something about the way of Jesus. It's a way. So either we're entering the way poorly, three steps forward, two steps back. I don't want to overshoot, like, but either we're trying to get, either we're putting our running shoes on and getting out on the trail, or we can't say we believe in running. So there's something there with this invitation into the yes is the doing.
Yes.
The yes. Wow, he was smart.
Yeah, that's how I hear Willard using it.
Of course, 100%.
Right?
Yes.
In that way of like, and it's our temptation that he's constantly fighting, that he's constantly pushing against, of like making an intellectual exercise.
Yes.
As opposed to like an actual live experience.
Yep.
that if we don't do, and I think that's the argument of like not trusting Jesus to be smart is the like, oh, I actually in my practice of life don't actually think he knows what he's talking
about. Right. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that overtly in certain Christian circles. And if you and me really were to search our inner world and our lived experience, we do that too. And so that's why I think humility is so critical. That's why walking with people who believe things differently and practice things differently is so critical. Because we start saying, wow, I might have missed this, or I might have set this part aside that I need to reconsider again.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, was there anything else that you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to?
Can I tell you about a practice that I've been doing that comes straight out of this chapter and this world that Dallas is inviting us into? And
please,
you know, there are many historic Christian practices, but this is one of the ones I call, like, what are my crazy make 'em up practices? And it's silly and it helps me a lot. And let me just tell you about it. I won't like make us do it here on the podcast, although I have done that. And I call it my coffee shop practice. And what I do is, you know, I'll get to a coffee shop and I'll get my coffee and get set up at my little table. And then I'll spend some time looking around the space, and I'll imagine that the coffee shop is filled floor to ceiling with water. Like, there's not a single molecule in this space that's not filled with water. And for some reason, we can all breathe just fine. And I look around at every single one of us fully immersed. And I just think that is how we are in God's presence right now. We are fully immersed. And it changes two things. First, it really does change how I see everyone else in that space. They are fully immersed in God's loving presence, whether they know it or not. And I may be by myself at this table, but I'm not alone. I am fully immersed in God's presence. And I mean, it's kind of silly. It really helps me. Side note, I had an experience once where I was looking at someone across the room and I just was like, God, thank you for that person. Thank you that you love them. Thank you that, and right at that moment, they looked up and saw me looking right at them. And I was, you know, I wanted to go over there and say, no, it's not weird. I was just imagining you were underwater with God or something, but I didn't think that would be helpful. So maybe to be a little cautious about that, but that is the way I want to be in every room. When I'm having a difficult conversation with my wife, I want to also imagine the reality that she is fully immersed in the loving presence of God, even as we're talking about this difficult thing. Or I've done this practice a couple times on the subway here in the city. And, you know, the subway can be a wild place. But to imagine that every single one of us sitting in this little thing riding under the city, fully immersed in God's loving presence, it really changes how I engage the world.
It's so good. It's one of the things that I've really learned from you, and I appreciate about you, Aaron, is taking these concepts like this and then figuring out, like, okay, what does it look like to make this more tactile and to do something with it that, like, becomes something that helps to change me? That it's like, you know, one of the things that I learned from Willard was the idea that a spiritual practice or a spiritual discipline is anything that you can do by direct effort that opens you up for God to do what you can't do by direct effort.
Yes.
And it's anything you can like it. There's so much freedom in that. And so I love the creativity and the way that, like, you are so good at, like, taking something, creating a tangible practice around it that helps to open us up for God to do this other thing.
Oh, man. So, thanks for saying that. It's like literally just from Dallas. I say this to start every retreat by saying a very similar thing. And that's this. Spiritual practices don't cause God to do anything. God is already doing everything. Spiritual practices simply open us up to what God has been doing all along. And so there is great goodness and wisdom in these simple, whether they're historic or crazy make-em-up practices that open us up to God's nearness.
Oh, that's so good. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Oh, man, what a gift. Thank you for doing that. I'm glad I got to share in your first New York earthquake.
First earthquake. I can't believe it. Yeah.
It was wild.
Maybe you caused it. I don't know.
You know, the cause behind the cause. Well, so folks will find the stuff that you're doing, Pastors, Priests, and Guides. We'll point them there. You've got a great book that I feel like taps into some of this called The Eternal Current, right? And gosh, that's got to be what, like 7, 8, 9 years old now?
Yeah. Yeah. Probably 7 years ago. And okay. And I'm realizing there's one whole chapter that's basically this conversation about where is God. So Dallas Willard is, I probably should send him royalties. But it was this book is our way of kind of fleshing out how we are creating a community around these ideas. So yeah, The Eternal Current.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Aaron, such a gift. Thanks for making some time today. I appreciate
it. Glad to be with you, my dude.